Today, I'm speaking with Hugo Mercier. Hugo is a cognitive scientist and research director at the CNRS at Institut Jean Nicot, Paris, where he works with the evolution and social cognition team.
The evolutionary argument against humans being gullible.
So the basic argument is one that was laid out by actually Richard Dawkins and a colleague in the 70s and then the 80s. It goes something like this. So within any species or across species, if you have two individuals that communicate, you have like senders of information and receivers of information, both have to benefit from communication. Like the sender has to, on average, benefit from communication. Otherwise, they would evolve to stop sending messages. But the receiver also has, on average, to benefit from communication. Otherwise, they would simply evolve to stop receiving messages, the same way as, you know, if you have like cave-dwelling animals might lose their vision because vision is pointless. If most of the signal you were getting from others was noise or it was even worse, it was harmful, then you would just evolve to stop receiving these signals.
Yeah. So in the book, you point out that a very natural way, like you, having said that, a lot of people will be thinking about persuasion and gullibility and convincingness and perceptiveness as a sort of evolutionary arms race between people's ability to trick one another and people's ability to detect trickery from others and not be deceived. But your take is that this is sort of the wrong way to think about it. Can you explain why?
Yes. No, I think this view of an arms race, it is tempting. But it's mistaken in that it starts from a place of great gullibility. It's like, you know, as if people started being gullible and then they evolved to be increasingly skeptical and so to increasingly reject messages. Whereas in fact, what we're seeing, you know, hypothetically, because we don't exactly know how our ancestors used to communicate, but if we extrapolate based on other great apes, for instance, we can see that they have a communication system that is much more limited than ours, and they're much more skeptical. Like, for instance, if you take a chimpanzee, and you try pointing to help the chimpanzee figure out where something is, the chimpanzee is not going to pay attention to you as a rule. They're very, very, you know, very, very skeptical, very defiant in a way, because they live in an environment in which they have little reason to trust each other. By contrast, if you take humans as an endpoint, I mean, obviously chimpanzees are not our ancestors, but assuming our last common ancestor was more similar to the chimps than it was to humans, if you take human as the opposite endpoint, we rely hugely on communication. Like we for everything we do in our everyday life, and that has likely been true for most of our recent evolution. And so that means that we have become able to accept more information. Like we take in vastly more information from others than any other great ape.
So one take would be that you need discerningness in order to be able to make the information useful to the recipient, because so that they can dismiss messages that are bad. But and there's kind of truth to that. But the other framing is just you need discerningness in order to make communication take place at all. Because if you were undiscerning, you would simply close your ears and, like many other species, basically just not listen to or pay no attention, do not process the information coming from other members of your species. So it's only because we were able to evolve the ability to tell truth from fiction that communication evolved as a human habit at all. Is that basically it?
Yes, no, exactly. You know, it's really striking in the domain of the evolution of communication, how you can find communication that works even within species, for instance, that you think would be very adversarial. Like if you take, you know, a typical example is kind of some gazelles and some of their predators, like packs of dogs. You think, well, they're pure adversaries. The dogs want to eat the gazelle doesn't want to be eaten. But in fact, some of gazelles have evolved this behavior of starting, where they jump without going anywhere. They just jump on the same place. And by doing that, they're signaling to the dogs that they're really fit and that they would likely outrun the dogs. And this signaling is possible only because this starting is a reliable indicator that you would outrun the dogs. Like it's impossible if you're a sick gazelle, if you're an old gazelle, if you're a young gazelle, if you're a gazelle with a broken leg, you can't do it. And so the dogs can believe, so to speak, the gazelles because the gazelles are sending an honest signal.
How AI could make the information environment worse.
Okay, so finally, I want to come to this other worry, which I called spam. And to me, this is the most plausible way that AI could make the information environment worse. And this is just helping to produce and disseminate just vast amounts of low quality or misleading content, even more than exists currently. And now we don't really expect that it's going to persuade anyone to buy any particular conclusions. But it's an alternative effect where it's just increasing the noise that's out there. It's just cluttering up the internet with lots of untrustworthy information where it's kind of effortful to figure out that it's untrustworthy because it's presented, you know, it's made it, it looks like a paper, it looks like a real study, it looks like a real blog post. And so people realize that this is the case and they just begin to mistrust everything that they see a little bit more because a lot of the cues that they might use to judge the credibility of things are no longer as reliable as they used to be because they're too easy to fake. So the end result is just that for practical reasons, they give up on trying to form strong views on most topics. And they end up feeling that it's just not really worth the effort to learn about what's going on because it's so easy to generate some fake video of events that never happened or fake papers purporting to show some conclusion or fake accounts creating the false impression about what people believe. And I think one reason I worry about this is that, as I understand it, this has kind of been an approach that many governments have used with their own populations when they're worried about them rebelling against them, is just to produce an enormous amount of noise and confusion. Where it's not that people believe that the regime is good, but they no longer like trust any particular thing that they're observing, so they just kind of opt out of public discourse. And I think it's kind of already the case for me to a great extent in many areas, because like basically I don't trust anything I read about the Russian invasion of Ukraine on social media because it just seems overrun with misleading propaganda from both sides, because almost everyone who talks about it is an advocate for one view or another. And so the end result of me observing this was just I invested less effort in understanding things because it seemed too hard to separate truth from lies. But I mean, this could be worse and it could be widespread across more issues. So yeah, what do you think of that risk? Can you imagine that being something that plays out over time?
I mean, my intuition would be that most people still rely on curation to a large extent. So you don't, you know, if you're going to trust a piece of news, to some extent you make up your own mind based on the content of the news. And if it's something that's too implausible, then you'll be skeptical. But for all the things that are within the range of things that are broadly plausible, the main moderator is going to be the source. So if you read that in a reliable newspaper, if it's tweeted by a colleague that you trust, you know, at least within a given area of expertise, then, you know, that's how you know that the information is reliable or at least kind of worth considering. And the fact that there's a lot of junk out there shouldn't change that fundamentally. Like, I mean, the only problem would be that if these, you know, these courtiers of information, these people who are going to relay information to you by curating it themselves, if they become less reliable, if their job becomes so hard that they stop being reliable, then everything, you know, stops working. But I'm not sure that LLMs are going to make the jobs of journalists in terms of, you know, figuring out what's true or not that different. I mean, you still have to talk to people, you still have to check your sources. And in many ways, LLMs can help them as well. So on balance, it's not clear it's going to make things harder. I mean, you're right when you were saying that the strategy of many governments that already have like a not very trustworthy political system is to increase that mistrust so that at least more potentially more trustworthy agents can't gain a foothold. That's why, you know, like the Germans were trying, in the Second World War, were trying to discredit the BBC because they knew it was like impossible to get the Germans to believe German propaganda anymore. But at least they could try to discredit, you know, the other side, and you have the same thing in Russia or in China, etc. But that can only work, I mean, if there is not much trust to start with. Like if you have some actors that are trusted, it's not obvious how you're going to make that trust go away.
Redefining beliefs.
Okay, so yeah, as mentioned above, you want to say that people professing silly beliefs that they don't actually act on or intuitively kind of incorporate into their world model, that doesn't show deep, like real gullibility. And there are also various other cases of seemingly really daft behavior that you want to defend and explain in the book as motivated by really understandable, pragmatic, selfish concerns. So basically, if people are persuaded that their self-interest requires them to say that they believe some stupid thing, then typically they are willing to do it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they've been persuaded of the belief on a deep level. So it's less, in these cases, an epistemic error and more a matter that they're kind of being bribed. They're being paid to claim that they believe in magic or whatever else. One of the examples of this you've mentioned earlier, or you've alluded to earlier, which is, you know, a non-trivial number of people said that they believe the Earth is flat, for instance. Mm-hmm. How could you explain that? And typically the reason is that people are really enjoying the social group, the kind of social dynamic that comes along with these flat earther groups. So is there much more to say about that other than that people who are kind of lonely and maybe don't feel like they have many allies in life often kind of look for unusual beliefs that can bind a group together that they can all profess, and then that increases the loyalty between them and allows them to hang out and feel like they have something special?
Yes, I think that's a potential explanation. It seems as if people who turn towards conspiracy theories are people who maybe don't have the status that they think they should have, in the sense that instead of being people who, you know, influence others in terms of having, you know, strong, you know, opinions about, you know, current events and these sort of things, they're, you know, they're mostly down to just, well, you have to accept what's in the newspaper, you have to accept what the authorities say, and that might not be fully satisfying. People, a lot of people want to, they want to contribute to creating their kind of their epistemic environment. And if you can't do that professionally, like if you're a journalist or a researcher or something like this, then it's tempting to do it in a way that will make up for it. But that because you're not in a nurturing kind of institutional context, it's kind of likely to go astray. So people do their own research and they create these sometimes, you know, very elaborate and quite knowledgeable theories about, you know, vaccination or the fact that the earth is flat or, you know, that whoever is killed. I can see in a way, I can really understand their motivation. And I was talking to a journalist who has studied a lot QAnon people. And what he was describing was the work that these people were doing and the feelings that they had when they felt they were uncovering new evidence was not very different from what he felt as a journalist when he was figuring out how, you know, a story was you know, making sense together. And so he really was understanding in a way their motivation. Like unfortunately, the outcome isn't great. But the motivation isn't intrinsically bad.
Vaccine hesitancy.
Okay, so yeah, similarly, you know, lots of people are reluctant to get vaccinations. And I guess people who are reluctant to get vaccinations have been pretty vilified in recent years. One explanation for this belief is generally bad judgment. Another might be that people are gullible and that they don't know who to trust. And so they're trusting these quack doctors. What's your explanation for why so many people are scared to get vaccinated?
So in a way, we can tell that it's not sheer gullibility because we find the same pattern everywhere and we have found it since the beginning of mandatory vaccination or inoculation in Britain about 2 centuries ago. So in every society, there will be a few percent of people who will quite staunchly oppose vaccination, you know, really kind of anti-vax people. And you'll have, you know, 10, 20, 15% or more who are more kind of vaccine hesitant. And that kind of, actually the worst country probably is actually France, which I'm a bit ashamed about. So you have this, and you find that just about everywhere in the world. Then again, you find that in England as soon as vaccination was introduced. So it just seems to be a fact of human nature that some people will find vaccination to be a bad thing. And I think it resonates with a lot of people, even people who are mostly pro-vax. You can at least sort of understand the intuition that injecting something that is related to a disease into a baby that is perfectly healthy doesn't seem like the most straightforward thing to do. Like, imagine if you didn't know anything about vaccination and you encounter a tribe that, you know, takes a bit of blood from a sick cow and puts it in a perfectly healthy baby, you're going to think that they're nuts. I'm taking the example of the cow because that's how inoculation started with kind of smallpox in the UK. Mm. So obviously, given everything we know about vaccination, you know, you should do it for all the vaccines that are recommended by the health system. But I can see how it's not the most intuitive therapy. It's not like if you have a broken arm and someone says, you know, probably we should put the bone, you know, right. Okay, sure, yeah, let's do it. They say, oh, your kid is perfectly fine. We should take this thing from that sick person and transform it and then put it in your kid. It doesn't sound great. So there's an intuition, I think, that many people share that vaccination isn't the best therapy. And we know that this is the prime driver and not the stories about vaccination causing autism, for instance, because as much as in every culture, there are people who are going to doubt vaccination, the reasons that they offer to justify that doubt are going to vary tremendously from one culture to the next. So in the West, it has been a lot recently about vaccines like the MMR vaccine in particular causing autism. It used to be that the smallpox inoculation would turn you into a cow. There are many cultures in which, you know, it's going to make you sterile, it's going to make you AIDS, it's going to make you all sorts of bad things to you. So the justifications vary a lot because these are the ones that you get from your environment. But the underlying motivation to dislike vaccine is pretty much universal. And not universal in the sense that everybody shares it, but in every population, you'll have people who are very keen on being anti-vax.
Yeah, so I mean, it does make a lot of sense. I think that, you know, I guess at most points in history, if doctors had said, "Well, what we should do is take the thing that makes someone else sick and put it on you," then that actually would have been pretty justified in saying, "I don't know, I think I'm just going to go get the homeopathy, take just the water, because that would be a much safer option." Mm-hmm,
exactly. Yeah.
It is quite counterintuitive that you should take someone who's healthy and then give them a transformed disease, basically. So it's just, I guess, an unfortunate fact of reality that actually is the best treatment.
That is really bad luck.
Yeah. Really bad luck for us.
open vigilance.
So it comes from the concept of epistemic vigilance, and it's really the same thing. It's just kind of rebranding. So the open comes from the fact that all of these mechanisms, as we were hinting at earlier, their main function really is to help us be more open, be more accepting of information, be influenced by others when they're right and when we're wrong. That is the ultimate function. Like, we start from a place of, you know, we just have our own beliefs that we form through perception and inference. And then the more open we are, the more we'll be able to benefit from the fact that other people have different knowledge, you know, they have different information from what we have, and we can use that. And the vigilance comes from the fact that this openness, as we're also kind of saying earlier, this openness is only made possible by the fact that we are vigilant. So it is because we check what people tell us and we check, you know, whether we can trust them or not, that we can afford to be open to what they're telling us.
Yeah. So in what ways would you say that we are open to new information?
Well, for instance, when someone gives you a good argument, people, you know, tend to change their minds. So it's something they've studied a lot in the lab, in which we give people like small logical or mathematical problems to which there is a perfect argument. Like, you can just demonstrate the correct answer in a relatively easy manner, even though most people get it wrong originally. And they, it's like, you know, like one of these kind of trick questions. People have a very strong intuition that they got it right. And in spite of that, when you give them a good argument, they change their minds quite easily. So that's in a way, the argumentation is the way in which you can exert the most maybe dramatic changes of mind when you have arguments that are strong enough.
Yeah. I mean, many people have the idea that giving people good arguments for beliefs is not always that effective. And often people will throw out good arguments on spurious grounds or just because they conflict with what they already believe. I think you have this example in the book of people who've studied whether people sensibly incorporate new information in changing their beliefs. And I think many listeners will, like me, have heard of this experiment where people who supported the Iraq war were told later on that WMDs were never found in Iraq, and in fact, they didn't exist. And that this, shockingly, caused them to become more in favor of the Iraq war rather than less, as you might expect. And I think you point out that there's been a whole slate of experiments of this type done, and that was actually the only case in which people's beliefs shifted, updated in the wrong direction relative to what you might expect. You know, in some cases, they didn't move so much, but that was the one case out of dozens in which it went in the wrong direction. Do you think to some extent people are maybe cherry-picking cases where folks are resistant to arguments and they ignore just the familiar everyday cases when arguments persuade us sensibly all the time?
Yes, yes. I think there are at least two documented cases of this backfire effect. There's another one with vaccine hesitancy, I think, for one specific vaccine and one specific range of the population. But yes, I mean, there are kind of now dozens, if not hundreds, of experiments showing that in the overwhelming or like the quasi, you know, entirety of the cases, when you give people a good argument for something that is based in facts that they would, you know, some authority that they trust, then they are going to change their mind. Maybe not enough, not as much as we'd like to, but the change will be in the direction that you would expect.
Yeah.
So that's really, and that's in a way, that's the sensible thing to do. And you're right that both kind of lay people and professional psychologists are and have been and still are very much attracted to demonstrations that human adults are, you know, irrational and a bit silly because it's more interesting. Like, if you show, well, look, people can speak, you know, it's like the most amazing thing maybe in the biological world. We have language. It's like, well, sure, obviously we have language. I mean, but if you say, oh, sometimes, you know, one times every maybe 50,000 words, there's a word that you can't remember. You have a tip of the tongue. Oh my God, this is amazing. You know, how are we brains, you know, working so poorly? So yeah, we are attracted by mistakes, by errors, by kind of silly behavior, but that doesn't mean this is representative at all.
Intuitive and reflective beliefs.
Yeah, intuitive beliefs are beliefs that are formed usually through perception. Like, you know, if I see there's a desk in front of me, you know, if I have an intuitive belief that there's a desk in front of me and I'm not going to try walking through it. I know I can put my laptop on it. And also beliefs that are formed through some simple forms of testimony. So if my wife tells me she's at home tonight, then I'm going to intuitively believe she's at home tonight. So I will base my behavior on that, and I will act as if I had perceived that she was at home tonight, for instance. And that's the vast majority of our beliefs, and things work really well. And these beliefs tend to be consequential and to have behavioral, you know, impact. By contrast, reflective beliefs are beliefs that we can hold them equally strongly as intuitive beliefs. So it's not just a matter of confidence, but they tend to be largely divorced from our behavior. So you can believe something, But either because you don't really know how to act on the basis of that belief or for some other reasons, it doesn't really translate into the kind of behavior that one would expect if you held the same belief intuitively. So an example that is really striking is conspiracy theories. So if you take someone who intuitively believes in a conspiracy, so for instance, someone who works in a company or in a government, and they've seen that their boss was, you know, shredding documents or was doing something really fishy, and they have good evidence that something really bad is going on, their reaction is going to be to shut up. They're going to be afraid for their jobs, you know, in some places for their lives. And it will be really, you know, they have a strong emotional component, and their behavior will be one of really not wanting to say anything, or if they say anything, they'll won't want to shout it from the rooftops. You know, they'll contact a journalist, you know, anonymously or something like this. And if you can contrast that to the behavior of conspiracy theorists who don't have actual, you know, perceptual or kind of firsthand evidence of a conspiracy going on, then these people, they tend not to be afraid. You know, they can say, oh, you know, I believe the CIA orchestrated 9/11 and they're this all-powerful, evil, you know, institution, and yet they're not going to kill me if I say this. And so they're just going to say, you know, at worst, they're going to say things, but they're, in a way, their emotional and behavioral reactions are really stunted or really different from what you would expect from someone who would have a similar intuitive belief.
Yeah, you give the contrast between... So in Pakistan, the intelligence services are known for engaging in all kinds of conspiracy theories all the time and engaging in, like, basically committing crimes on the regular in order to pursue their agenda. And everyone in Pakistan believes that this is the case, and they know intuitively that it's the case, mm-hmm. and they don't go out and organize a conference talking about how the security services are...
It would not happen, yeah.
how they orchestrated a terrorist attack, because they think that they would be killed, because...
Yeah, people who have tried would be dead, yeah.
right. By contrast, in other places where people believe that the security services are similarly... They claim to believe that the security services are equally evil and organizing terrorist attacks all the time, they don't seem to have much fear that there'll be any repercussion to saying this. And that's the difference between intuitive and reflective claims.
Yes. And ironically, that means that in a way, the more vocal conspiracy theories, the more everywhere it is, the less likely it is to be true in a way. Because
right, I
if it were, if it, I mean, at least when it comes to an actor that still has a lot of power now, I mean, if it comes to, you know, all things in the past, then, you know, fair enough. But if it comes to an actor, like an institution that is supposed to be really powerful now, the more you're saying, the more huge the claims are, the less likely it is to be correct. Otherwise, you know, you would not be out there saying that.
How people decide who to trust.
So there are two main dimensions of trust, really. So one has to do with competence. So essentially, how likely is it that what you're telling me is true? And that depends on how well informed you are, how much of an expert you are, whether you're someone who is very knowledgeable in a given area. And so for this, we keep track of like informational access, for instance. So if you tell me something about, let's say we have a friend in common and I know that you've seen her recently. If you tell me something about her, I will tend to believe you because presumably you're better informed because you've seen her more recently. More generally, we are pretty good at figuring out who is an expert in a given area, sometimes on the basis of relatively kind of subtle cues. And so we can, or even like, you know, let's, you have a friend who manages to fix your computer, you're going to think, well, you know, they're a good computer person and maybe you'll turn to them the next time you have a computer problem. So that's the competence dimension. So does that person know the truth? Like, do they have themselves accurate beliefs? And the other dimension, which is maybe what we really call trust in everyday life, is are they going to tell us that? Because, you know, if I can believe that you're the most expert person in the world in a given area, if I don't trust you, if I don't believe that you will tell me the accurate, you will share with me the accurate beliefs that you hold, then, well, it's no use to me. And that second dimension of really trust per se, it depends broadly on two things. One is your kind of short-term incentives. So even if you're, you know, you're my brother, you're a very good friend, if we play poker together, I'm not going to believe you. Because I know that if you tell me to fold, well, you know, you have no incentive to be truthful in the context of poker. We have like purely opposite incentives. So there's this kind of short term, you know, what can you get from me with that specific message? And then there's the long term incentives. Like, are you someone whose kind of interests are kind of intermeshed with mine and someone who would benefit from me doing well? And is that something that's going to be true, you know, kind of moving forward? So if you're a family member, if you're a good friend, I know that you don't have any incentive to, or like very small incentives to mislead me, because then that will jeopardize our relationship, and the cost to you as well as to me would be quite high.
Yeah. So would you generally say that we have good judgment about who to trust?
Yes, on the whole. I mean, we make mistakes, but we're on the whole, I think we're pretty good. And I think most of the mistakes we make are mistakes of the type of we don't trust people enough rather than trusting them too much.